From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is David J. Kramer, Senior Fellow in the Vaclav Havel Program on Human Rights and Diplomacy at Florida International University's Green School of International and Public Affairs. He's the author of a new book on U.S.-Russia relations entitled Back to Containment, Dealing with Putin's Regime. David previously served as Senior Director for Human Rights and Democracy at the McCain Institute for International Leadership, which published the book. David retains an affiliation with the Institute, which is named in honor of Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona, a staunch supporter of democracy and freedom around the world. In the book, Kramer traces the rise of Vladimir Putin and the U.S.-Russian relationship over the course of the administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He argues that the Putin regime is a serious threat to the United States and the Western world, and that Washington needs to develop a tougher policy of containment and pushback. This contrasts with statements from current U.S. President Donald J. Trump, who has consistently said that he wants to improve relations with Russia. However, Mr. Trump's aspirations have faced strong bipartisan opposition in Congress, which recently approved a new set of sanctions against Moscow for its interference in the U.S. presidential election. Apropos, Congress and others are scrutinizing Russia's alleged use of social media to influence the U.S. presidential election, from Twitter bots to Russians posing as Americans on Facebook and taking ads on Facebook. According to Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, quote, "This amounts to a brazen exploitation and distortion of popular opinion by a hostile foreign power, amounting to an attack on our democracy to disrupt our election by surreptitiously targeting voters in certain places with certain backgrounds and views," unquote. As for our guest, David Kramer, he says it's important to distinguish between the regime of Vladimir Putin and Russia as a whole. David says, quote, "Our problems are with the Putin regime. We should stop seeing Putin as anything other than a paranoid authoritarian leader who oversees one of the most corrupt regimes in the world," unquote. Prior to his current post and his affiliations with the McCain Institute for International Leadership, David Kramer also served as president of Freedom House and as Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. And David Kramer joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Carol, thanks very much for having me.
We're delighted to have you, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
And let's talk about that. You say that the very nature of Putin's regime makes real cooperation between Russia and the United States virtually impossible, except perhaps on arms control or non-proliferation. And even on that, there are some questions. And given that 11 or more of U.S. intelligence agencies have determined that Moscow, Putin's Russia, interfered in the U.S. election, undermining our democracy, I suppose that only strengthens your argument.
I think we're people who argue for engagement with Russia, and I would agree, is that we don't share values with Putin's Russia. And as you said in your introduction, it's important to distinguish between Russia and Russians writ large and the Putin regime. We don't share any values. Putin oversees an incredibly authoritarian and corrupt kleptocratic regime, and he demonizes the West. He demonizes NATO. He demonizes the EU, the United States, of course, and he tries to discredit the whole concept and notion of democracy. So I think even realists can agree that we don't share values. Where we probably disagree is whether we have some interests in common. And there, as you said, I think increasingly we don't. If you look at the whole range of issues that we're facing and dealing with in today's world, from North Korea, where Russia has watered down UN Security Council resolutions and is providing support to the Kim regime, in Afghanistan, where they have provided support to the Taliban, Taliban, even arming the Taliban, which is an indirect way of supporting al-Qaeda. On Iran, they provide advanced weapon systems with Iran, and they work with Iran to prop up the Assad regime in neighboring Syria, where Russia has intervened militarily not to go after ISIS, but to keep Assad in power. And then, of course, you have the invasions of Georgia in 2008, of Ukraine in 2014, and continuing today. And then, as you mentioned, gross interference in our election last year. It's hard to see where we have common interests these days. Arms control, Russia doesn't seem all that interested. I'm not sure the Trump administration is all that interested in an arms control agreement. On nonproliferation, North Korea is the biggest test of that. We'll see. Even on the Arctic, I think we'll be competing more than we will cooperate. So a range of issues where I just don't see much common ground.
So that leads us to question or try to figure out how it is that U.S. President Donald Trump still somehow sees the possibility of cooperation, but he more and more seems like an outlier, even vis-a-vis members of his own administration.
I think we do see a distinction between the things that the president says and the aspirations that he voices and the actual actions of the administration. And when you look at Vice President Pence's trip in the summer to Estonia and Georgia, the vice president reiterated U.S. support for Georgia's membership in NATO one day. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but he reaffirmed the 2008 Bucharest NATO communique, which said Georgia and Ukraine will become members of NATO. He provided very important support to Estonia, which is one of NATO's frontline states neighboring Russia. You look at the beefing up of U.S. and NATO military presence further to NATO's east and closer to Russia's border. You look at the increase in exports of U.S. energy, which is another way to get at Putin's regime. So you look at the actions of the Pentagon, of the State Department, the Treasury Department, which has kept sanctions in place, and the vice president, and then you see the rhetoric of the president. It's almost like a parallel world, and this may be one of those times where it's as important, if not more so, to focus on the actions rather than the talk.
Well, let's talk about your strategy back to containment, dealing with Putin's regime. What are you recommending that the United States do, I assume, in partnership with its allies in Europe?
The first thing I think we have to do is to recognize the threat that the Putin regime poses. As I argue in the book, it is a threat to its own people, first and foremost. Anyone who criticizes or challenges Putin is going to face harassment, intimidation, arrest, and possibly poison and murder. We saw that, of course, with Boris Nemtsov, who was a friend of mine, shot and killed in February 2015, with Vladimir Karamurza, who is another friend of mine, who has been poisoned twice. Alexei Navalny was recently put in jail for a 20-day sentence, and the Central Election Commission has said he is not eligible to run because of phony convictions and cases brought against him. So anyone who challenges Putin faces some real threats, and so the Russian people, first and foremost, are threatened by the Putin regime. Then you look at Russia's neighbors, Ukraine, the cyber attack against Estonia, the use of energy and cutting off energy supplies to Ukraine in the height of winter in 2006 and 2009, the threats against other countries, the continued presence of Russian forces in Transnistria, despite the Moldovan government's request for them to leave. Putin simply doesn't recognize the right of these nations to be free, independent states to determine their own future, whether it's closer relations with NATO and/or the EU. In any revolutionary or popular movements that he sees in these countries, he refuses to believe that the people themselves indigenously could be behind these movements, and he ascribes to them that American motivations and American conspiracy. The third level of threat is to the West, with the interference in our politics, our systems, to try to discredit them, to influence them, to tip an election in a certain direction. And so we have to recognize that the regime in Moscow is a threat to us. That's step number one. Step number two, bolster the neighbors. Provide the lethal assistance to Ukraine that they have asked for. They have not asked for American troops to be on the ground to fight the battle for them. They simply want to be able to fend off Russian tanks or Russian aircraft should they come in and add to the fighting there. Support Georgia. Continue to keep the door open to NATO and the EU for aspiring countries like Georgia and Ukraine. And make sure the frontline states of NATO are getting the necessary protection and reassurance that they need. And we also also have to recognize that there are forces in Russia that want a better future. This gets at the point of not ascribing everything that's happening in Russia to the whole population. I think the system is more fragile. The whole environment is more fragile than we tend to think. I think back to 2011 with the movements in the Arab world, where we learned the expression, these regimes seem stable until they're not. And so we shouldn't assume that Russia is a hopeless case. I think there are many Russians who want a better future. They're fed up with the corruption. This is one of the reasons Navalny is viewed as a threat, because he keeps exposing cases of corruption of people like Peskov and others. And it resonates with Russians who are fed up with the corruption. And then we also have to make sure that we deal with the corruption problem. Putin's biggest export, greatest export, is corruption. But in order to export it, we have to import it. So we need to clean up our own act and make sure that we are not leaving ourselves vulnerable to Russian corruption. When it comes to the information and propaganda, we have to recognize that we shouldn't get into the trenches with RT or Sputnik or anything like that. We should make sure we provide all the information to Russian viewers and listeners, as well as listeners and viewers along the whole region, so that they understand what's really going on both inside Russia and in their own countries and in the United States. And we have to make sure we treat RT and Sputnik for what they really are. They're not real journalist organizations.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that before we go to a break. RT, Russia Today, very slick television network that we see here in the United States. And yet, some people do not know that it is literally a propaganda organ of the Kremlin. So that leads us to ask you, David Kramer, should there be some sort of a caveat associated with RT? I mean, right now, unless one knows, you know, what RT really is, you could be duped into thinking that it's a normal network produced by Russia, but we know it has a bias, that it is propagandistic, that it harps on America's seamier side, again, that it promotes the Russian, the Kremlin line. How should we treat RT differently or not?
In the book, I argue that we shouldn't treat RT and Sputnik as normal journalist organizations. They're not.
But they are treated that way, aren't they, today?
They are allowed into press briefings in the State Department, in the White House. And at a minimum, we should not treat RT and Sputnik as normal news organizations. They're not. They are to both peddle Kremlin propaganda and to undermine our own system. And they do it in a sophisticated, clever fashion. And they try to sell what they do in a clever way. But perhaps most nefarious, what they do is they put out stories into the internet world. And most of these kinds of stories are ridiculous, but they get picked up by reputable organizations and people lose the thread on where they originated. And so you get stories out into the social media that really shouldn't see the light of day. I support the push, it seems, by the Justice Department to require them to register under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. That won't shut them down, and I'm not saying we should shut them down, but I also want to focus on where they get their funding from. They get it from the Russian government, from the Russian budget. And if there are court cases that Russian entities lose, whether in the European Court of Human Rights or in The Hague and the arbitration courts there, then we should participate in enforcing those court decisions by seizing the property of RT and Sputnik here in the United States, given that they are funded by the Russian government. So to me, it's a way of dealing with this threat and recognizing that people who work for these organizations, particularly if they're Americans or others, should know better, frankly.
Indeed, they should know that they're being used.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is David J. Kramer. He's senior fellow in the Vaclav Havel Program on Human Rights and Diplomacy, Back to Containment, Dealing with Putin's Regime. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Jalalabad, Afghanistan, Fazal Haq Maksudjiar. Thanks for writing. And if you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, David J. Kramer. And speaking of Facebook, that leads me to my next question about Russia's infiltration of Facebook, Twitter. Facebook quantified recently for the first time the spread of the unknown Russian activity since the social network said in September that it had identified at least 470 inauthentic Russian-backed accounts responsible for $100,000 in advertising spending. And Facebook recently presented congressional investigators with data on about 3,000 ads bought by Russian actors before and after the U.S. presidential election. So again, David Kramer, this is going to another level of interference in our democracy, of using a social network platform, Facebook, being exploited, and then Americans believing that these ads are from other sources in the United States, when in fact, this is a foreign adversary. So what do you make of this?
It points to a bit of an irony, frankly, which is that the Kremlin, the regime, its propagandists demonize the West. They view us as a threat. They say that we are a military threat, that we're trying to spawn revolutions along Russia's borders and in Russia itself. The color revolutions of over a decade ago really spooked Putin. The irony is that as they demonize the West and view us as a threat, they also send their children to study in the West. They stash their ill-gotten gains in the West. They like to visit and vacation in the West. And they exploit our openness, the welcoming nature of our societies. And so they set up operations in our countries, and they do so with social media. I myself have to admit I'm technologically illiterate, but I don't do Facebook or Twitter or any of that. But the Russians do. And they have tapped into a source of information for many Americans, again, that gets picked up in certain venues and then exponentially carries weight. So it is a huge problem, particularly when it is done not only to try to influence an election, but to stir up social problems in this country. We have enough challenges as it is on our own. We don't need Russian Twitter accounts or Facebook pages to be tapping into some of our sensitive issues and trying to fuel a fire, if you will. We should be handling those on our own without any gross interference coming from Moscow.
And of course, that leads some lawmakers and others to recommend, for example, that these social media platforms, for example, like Facebook, that they should be held to the same transparency standards as other companies that sell political advertisements, other broadcasters. In fact, Senator Amy Klobuchar is promulgating legislation that would hold these social media companies to account, that Facebook, Google, and Twitter would have to abide by the same transparency requirements as traditional broadcasters, radio, and satellite providers. Do you think that's an important method of combating Russian nefarious influence here in this country and could also send a signal around the world?
As you rightly said at the end of your question, Carol, this is a problem not just in the United States. It's a problem in France with their election. President Macron, soon after he won that election, singled out RT and Sputnik and social media that Russians exploited for trying to interfere in the French election. You look at the support for AFD in Germany through Twitter and other kinds of accounts. And so this is a problem not just for the United States. I think the push by Congress to require full disclosure is absolutely right. Just like in the New York Times or on TV or whatever mainstream media, if you will, where there are advertisements, they have to say paid by or approved by. And the same should be done on social media. I don't think it should be treated any differently. And the social media becoming more and more important and influential these days. It's something we're still coming to grips with in terms of the impact it has, but we have to do it quickly.
Exactly. It may not help regarding what has been done, but certainly for the 2018 elections and for going forward. And I think Americans and people around the world who use social media, Facebook, Google, Amazon, Twitter, need to become a little more literate. scrutinizing where the information is coming from, the sources of some of the articles they're reading on Facebook, to realize that unless it's edited by a well-known news organization, whether the New York Times or the Washington Times or Wall Street Journal or whatever, that they should really be very careful about the source of the news on social media, that as well. So people have to become more literate, whether here in the United States or around the world, as a result of this Russian infiltration of our social media.
Absolutely. I mean, sourcing these reports that come out is critically important, and following the thread, so that when you get an outrageous lie that's put out by Russian disinformation, that a 13-year-old Russian-German teenager was raped by immigrants in Germany a couple years ago, it's very important that German authorities set the record straight, number one, and number two, that they find out where that phony story came from. And it clearly came out of Russia. So we have to do that in the United States. They have to do it in Germany. They have to do it everywhere in the Western world, where Russian bots and others and trolls see openings, and we have to close those openings to them.
Absolutely. We have to demand of the officials at Facebook and Twitter that they be held to account for the political advertisements on their platforms, that there should be more transparency, because what in fact is going on are fake accounts. And we remember in the summer of 2016, somebody by the name of Melvin Reddick, an all-American family from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, when in fact it was a fake account created to try to influence the U.S. electorate.
And the photo of that individual was actually of a Brazilian.
That's right. So we talked about Russian strategy, whether Ukraine, the Baltic states. Do you see any change in behavior from Moscow vis-a-vis eastern Ukraine? Of course, their annexation of Crimea, it looks like a fait accompli, although it is illegal. It is an upending of the post-World War II order. Not sure how we're going to get that reversed, but this should not stand. I mean, what is Vladimir Putin after, in your view?
On Crimea, I think it's very important that we maintain the position that we had toward the Baltic states after they were absorbed illegally and by the Soviet Union. We never recognized the incorporation of the Baltic states into the Soviet Union. We should never recognize the illegal annexation of Crimea by Russia. And if it takes however many years, that's the position we should maintain. On what he's up to more broadly, he's floated this idea for a UN presence in the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine. I think that was done before the UN General Assembly to try to deflect any guilt that he might have been attributed to him for what's happening there. I don't take that seriously. I don't take seriously the proposal that his representatives put forward to Washington in March about trying to return to normal relations. He wants normal relations on his terms, where he doesn't have to recognize any mistakes. The whole reset was, in the Russian officials' minds, that we were admitting problems we made in the past, that they didn't have anything they had to fix or correct. I think we have to make it clear that there is no possibility of return to normal relations as long as Russia continues its aggression against Ukraine. It's not a civil war there. It is a Russian war against Ukraine. And as long as Russia maintains an illegal presence in Georgia or Moldova, or continues to slaughter innocent civilians in Syria or attack humanitarian convoys or threaten our forces that are there trying to support more democratically, moderately inclined forces in Syria, as long as it undermines the sanctions in North Korea, supports the Taliban in Afghanistan, aligns with the regime in Tehran, and who knows who was behind this terrible attack against American citizens in Cuba. Some people have speculated there may have been a Russian hand behind it. It's not to say that the Cubans should be left off the hook. But Russia seems to be on the offensive these days. And we need to stop playing defense and go on the offensive ourselves to put Putin back on his heels and to let him know that the United States is not going to be bossed around.
Well, that's a very good point. And with regard to Cuba, that actually occurred to me as well, that the Russians may be behind that, but we don't have the evidence yet.
Right.
Nonetheless, they have done enough damage.
Think about the harassment and intimidation they do of our diplomats in Russia. Obviously, the Russian government bears responsibility for that. And part of the sanctions that President Obama imposed in December of last year were also in response to the harassment that American diplomats face. And of course, after we expelled 35 Russian officials here, the Russian government, several months later, forced our embassy to scale back significantly. This is not an even exchange. And I think this is where the president president should have taken a much tougher position rather than thanking Putin for cutting down on the payroll. This is where the U.S. was right to close down the consulates in San Francisco and New York. And it's that kind of action that I think is appropriate. Appointing Kurt Volker, for example, is a special envoy for dealing with the Ukraine-Russia crisis. That was also a good move. In full disclosure, Kurt is a friend and former colleague at the McCain Institute. So again, we do see some of these actions that reflect well on what the U.S. is doing. It needs to be matched up with the rhetoric as well.
And as you alluded to earlier, Russia is certainly meddling in the affairs of other countries in Europe, in their elections, whether in Germany, whether in France, in the Netherlands. And even though many of these far-right parties did not win outright, we can certainly say that there have been gains. And certainly in Germany, the AfD, the third largest number of seats in parliament, it's rather frightening. And we know that Vladimir Putin's Russia must have had a hand in that, perhaps not the only influence. So the question then is, can the Europeans, the European Union as a whole, in particular countries like Germany and France, do you see them holding strong against Vladimir Putin's influence?
Marine Le Pen openly acknowledged she received $10 million from Russia. Unless and until European countries and governments outlaw foreign funding of political candidates and political parties, Russia will continue to find a way to insert influence in these elections. So Europe and we too need to clean up our electoral systems. We need to make sure that the Russians who are in their countries are abiding by the same rules and regulations as anyone else living in those countries. And we need to go after Russian money where it is and shouldn't be, because we should keep in mind, not to say that every Russian is involved in corruption, but some of the high-stakes rollers have accumulated their wealth through ill-gotten gains, and they shouldn't be allowed to use our systems, our banking networks, our financial institutions as a way of safekeeping their funds.
And of course, by criticizing Russia and the regime and its authoritarian order, nobody is saying that the United States is some kind of a paragon of virtue. I mean, we have so many errors here. We have a great deal of inequalities, and we're dealing with, you know, a mass shooting recently. I mean, we have our own problems, but it still does not in any way absolve the Russian regime of its very corrupt and nefarious activities. And that's why it's important that we don't make moral equivalencies.
Right.
But many say, oh, look at America, look at its racism, poverty. But what's really happening is sometimes Moscow is actually behind the divisiveness, whether through social media, trying to, in fact, exploit these issues. So how can the people really get the straight story?
One of the smartest things Putin did, and it wasn't good for the country, but it was good for him, was to take over the TV networks from Vladimir Gusinsky and Boris Berezovsky early on in his reign. Taking over those two nationwide TV channels enabled Putin to control the information. Most Russians get their news and information via TV, although some recent polls suggesting that there is a decline in the trust that Russians have for the news that they are getting from their authorities. And you're absolutely right. We see very few independent outlets left. There's Echo Moskvy, Novaya Gazeta. Medusa had to leave the country. Yulia Latinina, a commentator, recently had to flee the country after numerous attacks against her. Anna Politkovskaya, of course, was shot and killed in her apartment building. And we've seen other cases of journalists poisoned or harassed or killed. And so the media environment in Russia is very ugly. We in the West have to do everything we can to make sure that Russians are able to somehow, and they're creative people, they'll figure out a way to get objective news and information. And it's also why it's so important for Western news organizations to do their job, which is to report the news, not to engage in counter-propaganda, because that undermines our own credibility. It puts us at the same level of Russian organizations that propel their propaganda. What made us different from the Soviet Union was that we stood for values and principles. We have to return to those values and principles. We have to make sure that we stand for the freedoms that many of us take for granted. You're absolutely right. We in the United States still have many problems and challenges in this country. The terrible shooting this week in Las Vegas is the latest evidence of that. Police brutality issues, and the Russians try to exploit these things. We all have weaknesses. We all have vulnerabilities. But at the end of the day, if we stand by our values and principles, we'll be on much firmer ground.
The book is Back to Containment, Dealing with Putin's Regime. The author, David Kramer, he's senior fellow in the Vaclav Havel Program on Human Rights and Diplomacy at Florida International University's Green School of International and Public Affairs. David Kramer, thank you so much for coming in, and congratulations on your terrific book.
Carol, thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Daryl Smith. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.